This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Derek walks you through how to win government jobs and contracts, effectively manage your government career, and best utilize government services. Every week on Fed Access, you'll learn about interesting federal agencies, workers, and jobs. Fed Access provides you the access you need to succeed in the federal government. And now your host, Derek T. Dortch.
Welcome to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Thank you for stopping by the show. Today, we're going to be talking about what's going on, some international issues. We're going to be talking about both issues, about the Middle East and also talking about Mexico later on in this show. But right now, we're going to have two experts from Stratfor. Stratfor is a global geopolitical intelligence firm. They do a lot of forecasting and analysis on a number of global issues that deal with America, but also just the world. Multinational corporations subscribe to their analysis. Government agencies subscribe to their analysis. And so they keep on monitoring what's happening. Today, we're going to be talking to Jacob Shapiro. He's a Middle East analyst at Stratfor, and you can find him at stratfor.com. But Jacob, thank you for coming on Fed Access.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, you know, this Egypt situation has been evolving, and it's been in and out of the news depending on what's happening right now. But there's been this dynamic where the military has now taken back over the country, from the rulers who at first took the country back over some time ago with the military's help. So what's happening in Egypt right now?
Yeah, I mean, it's... Honestly, from our point of view, the military never really relinquished control.
Okay.
In 2011, when the original protests against Mubarak arose, and everybody was talking about popular revolution and the Arab Spring, what we really saw was that Mubarak was trying to pass rule over to his son Gamal. And what Gamal wanted to do was he wanted to reform the Egyptian economy. Mainly, he wanted to take away some of the economic and political interests that the military had developed over its decades in power. So when the protesters sort of came out in 2011, the military saw an opportunity to get rid of Mubarak and to then install a new government that it would hope would look out for its interests more. Eventually, Morsi got elected. He lasted about a year until the military decided that he wasn't quite cutting it either. And during Morsi's time in office, he managed to anger and annoy just about every single political segment of the Egyptian society. So after a year, we saw those huge protests that were even bigger than the ones in 2011 against Mubarak, and the military intervened again. So in some ways, we're sort of right back where we started in 2011, where the military decided that it needed to come in and assert itself and make sure that its interests were protected.
You know, President Obama and other world leaders had really been promoting that hopefully Egypt had a new chance for democracy. And from what you're saying, you know, and from what we're hearing in terms of the analysis, is that this was more kind of a fake democracy almost? I mean, since the military still kind of had its eyes on the ruling party and kind of said, and since they decided, well, this is not working out, we're going to go, instead of waiting for the political process of the next elections, you know, was this a dynamic that the democracy was never, ever a real democracy?
Yeah, so, I mean, this question comes up a lot, and I think a lot of the sort of confusion about it is that you really have to define your terms. Yes, Morsi was absolutely elected in a democratic election that was pretty much widely saluted as fair and legitimate and all those other good things. But the problem is that when you look at Egypt's political history, I mean, going back centuries, this is a country that has been ruled by some sort of military bureaucratic dictatorship. And in fact, I mean, the Egyptians themselves, the Arabs themselves, have only ruled Egypt since 1952. Before that, it was a monarchy that was representative of not even the Arabs themselves. So from that point of view, like, this is a very young state, and it's very young when it comes to politics. So yes, you can have a democratic election, and yes, you can put someone in office just through an election. Does that make something a democracy? Does that mean that that country is going to overnight adopt the sort of liberal democratic values of freedom of the press and freedom of religion and all of these things that we associate with the word democracy here in the United States when we use those words? No, these things don't happen overnight. And what you sort of saw with Morsi, he was democratically elected. He went into office. But as soon as he went into office, he sort of decided that that was a mandate for him to do whatever he wanted to do. And during his time in office, he tried to basically silence some of the opposition, restrict press access. There was at one point in November 2012 where he issued a declaration that said that his from now on, his edicts were going to be above constitutional review by the courts. I mean, this is just sort of the way the political environment in Egypt is right now, and it's going to need time to develop. So you can have a democratic election. Does that mean that the liberal democratic values that we would associate with democracy are there? Not yet. Now, this might be the first sort of utterings of it, the first indications that Egypt might want that for its political future. But that's going to be a long process, and that's going to happen over a long period of time.
You know, the Brotherhood, the Muslim Brotherhood, has been really pushing to kind of say this has been a military coup, and they want, you know, President Obama, they want other world leaders to kind of, you know, almost revoke this and kind of say this is, you know, rather than, you know, people just kind of seeing it as maybe a change of administration, and we're just kind of, you know, retweaking things or whatever the case is. They want to look at it as the military has taken over power again, and this is not right for democracy and everything else. Do you see world leaders heading in that direction? Or do you kind of see it as really kind of holding back to kind of see how this thing plays out? And does the Muslim Brotherhood have a play in this? I mean, is there going to be new? I mean, where are you seeing this going? Is it going to be new elections? Will they still be on the ballot? Or are we talking about a new leader? Where is this going to go?
Yeah, so the Muslim Brotherhood has quite a few decisions to make for itself. But just to start off, I mean, when they're trying to call it a military coup, and by the way, I mean, if we're just talking about what it was a military coup. Mm-hmm. There's really no, like, in terms of definitions, it absolutely was. When the Muslim Brotherhood and other people are trying to, are using those words, though, they are trying to basically call in some restrictions in the House Appropriations Bill on financial aid that the U.S. can give to other governments, because there's a clause in there that says that if in a country the military removes the government by coup, then U.S. aid is supposed to be suspended to that country. And there's a whole host of political issues that would happen if the United States was going to have to do that. So the United States is looking at it and saying, okay, well, the military removed them, but there were also how many millions in the streets, and there was popular dissatisfaction. And so those are sort of, it's a political use of the term military coup when the Muslim Brotherhood's using it. In terms of what the Muslim Brotherhood is going to do, it's important to keep in mind that the Muslim Brotherhood was founded in 1928. It's been illegal in Egypt for most of its existence. It was outlawed and cracked down on pretty intensely in 1954 by the then dictator Gamal Abdel Nasser. So they've had a lot of practice at being in the opposition and in surviving in the opposition in sort of much worse circumstances. So I think what you see is that you'll see the Muslim Brotherhood, as they have been since Morsi was removed, you're going to see them continuing to demonstrate in the streets. You're going to see them continuing to try and show the military, look, we represent a huge segment of this population, and you can't just ignore us. They're going to rely on the things that brought them to power in the first place, which was providing social services like healthcare and education outside the main cities in Egypt that weren't provided for as well by Cairo and by the central government. And they're basically going to try and keep up that rhetoric and keep it up such that they can come to the bargaining table with the military and with whatever civilian government they prop up and say, look, you have to include us in the process. You have to include us in the conversation. We should also just note that there were Islamists who signed on to the military coup that removed Morsi. The second largest Islamist party in the country, the Al-Nur Party, which is a Salafist party, they were part of the negotiations that removed Morsi. So the Islamists themselves are sort of fractured. The Muslim Brotherhood's not going away. They've been a political force in Egypt for a long time, and they will come back from this. It's just a question now of what they can leverage and how much they can get at the negotiating table.
With you know, and we kind of talked about democracy, and in terms of Egypt, when we look at democracy, and of course it's definitely different from our society, are they trying to use the same democratic society? I mean, are they trying to put this in place where a president will serve for 4 years, or I mean, what's the term limits? If this thing was supposed to work correctly, how would it look?
So we don't actually know the answer to that question, because the old constitution has been suspended, and in the interim constitution, basically the new president, Adli Mansour, has just about every single power in the book. He has complete legislative powers, complete executive powers. About the only thing he can't do is he can't declare war on his own, and he can't call a state of emergency on his own. He would need sort of approval from generals or from his cabinet to do that. But otherwise, all the power is in him in terms of this interim government. Now, what's going to happen going forward, and the Egyptian interim government has laid out a very specific timeline about how it wants to write a new constitution and put it up for national referendum and have new parliamentary and presidential elections. And that in part goes back to what we were talking about earlier, demonstrating to the United States that no, this wasn't a military coup. Yes, we are putting these processes in place to have a civilian elected government back in place. But if you believe their timeline, they're talking about having new presidential elections within 9 months. And in the period before we get there, they're talking about writing a new constitution, having it ratified by the entire Egyptian population, and then also holding parliamentary elections. Mm-hmm. So in Egypt, we've seen a lot of political deadlines floated before. Morsi was supposed to have a constitution, also was supposed to have parliamentary elections done too. So I wouldn't necessarily take those on face value, but they definitely are trying to move towards that system. But ultimately, you know, what it says on a piece of paper and what it says in the constitution doesn't matter as much there as it would here, because ultimately the military is calling the shots there. And for as long as the military is calling the shots there, and for as long as the military doesn't feel comfortable with sort of opening the country and having election be sort of a more liberal process and more democratic, it doesn't really matter what a constitution is going to say, because the military is just going to intervene whenever its interests are fundamentally threatened.
We're talking about international issues on Fed Access today. We're talking about Egypt and what's going on with that country, the impact on the global society, the impact on America, as we look at some changing issues. The military now taking control of that government. Egypt has been an ally of the United States in the Middle East, and we're trying to figure out where this thing is going. We're talking to Jacob Shapiro. He is a Middle East analyst at Stratfor. You can find him at Stratfor.com. And Stratfor is a geopolitical intelligence organization who's, you know, doing a number of different analyses on the Middle East and all over the world. We'll be right back and continue this conversation on Fed Access. You're listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Deutsch. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Deutsch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we're talking about international issues on Fed Access today. We're talking about the Middle East. We're talking about what's going on in Egypt right now. A lot of consequences and a lot of implications for America in terms of Egypt, in terms of the new rule, democracy in Egypt. They're one of the Middle East allies that we have. And of course, in the Middle East, we're always trying to get a handle on a number of different situations in that environment, and they always have an impact on us, whether it be oil, whether it be trade, whether it be crisis situations or whatever the case is. We always have to try to monitor what's going on in the Middle East. We're talking to Jacob Shapiro. He's a Middle East analyst at Stratfor. You can find him at Stratfor.com. They're a geopolitical intelligence organization that monitors a number of different issues and is definitely watching Egypt very, very closely. Jacob, you know, there's an article you guys have about Egypt's military looks to manage Sinai's militants, and it looks like they're trying to bring them back to tolerance levels. What is that article discussing? What are you guys looking at when you're talking about that?
Well, it's odd. The media sort of picked this up later on, but so the day after the big protest started in Egypt that eventually resulted in Morsi being removed, the Egyptian military actually dispatched tanks to the Sinai Peninsula and a bunch of infantry battalions and stuff like that. So they were expecting this kind of backlash from the Islamists in the Sinai Peninsula, in part because those Islamists in the Sinai Peninsula definitely felt like Morsi was their guy, and definitely had a lot of respect and admiration for the stuff that Morsi was doing. The Sinai is, because of its geography and because of where it is, it's just a relatively lawless, violent place in general, but definitely in recent months we had seen it be even more violent than usual. So when the military decided that it was going to remove Morsi, it decided at the same time that it first of all needed to have troops in the Sinai to make sure that stuff didn't get out of control there. But then also they took the advantage to kind of take two birds with one stone. So they've basically embarked on a larger military operation. I think there are something like 11 infantry battalions there right now and two tank battalions. They've cleared all this with the Israelis. There are laws and stuff like that in the 1979 treaty between Egypt and Israel that restrict the amount of military hardware and troops that can be there, but they've cleared this all with Israel. And they're basically in the Sinai trying to clean up militancy there and trying to make sure basically of two things. Number one, they want to stop the flow of both militants and weapons from Gaza into Egypt and vice versa. They really want to clamp down on that flow. And the other thing that they want to do is they want to make sure that these Islamists actually aren't targeting Israel, because if these Islamists from the Sinai start targeting Israel or get their hands on weapons and decide that they're going to target Israel to try and create a distraction for the government in Cairo, Israel then might feel like it's going to have to take action on its own and might have to actually do stuff on its own. And that's something that Egypt really wants to avoid. It wants to be able to take care of its stuff in-house. So those are really the two main things that it's trying to accomplish in the Sinai.
So these weapons get into the militants' hands. We're talking about possibly an uprising. We're talking about maybe terrorist activities. We're talking about a number of different things. Like you said, there can be a very, very a big distraction for possibly a new democracy coming aboard, right?
Yes, absolutely. And I think one thing to look at is that the Muslim Brotherhood in general in Egypt has long been a pragmatic organization. They sort of haven't really used organized violence in any meaningful way. But I think one thing that we've certainly been keeping an eye on is, look, like their president was just deposed. He was just removed in a military coup. Just because the organization as a whole sort of has this pragmatic history doesn't mean that you're not going to get segments in it that aren't radicalized, or who might decide that, look, we participated in this democratic process and look what it got us. Maybe we need to sort of do some more radical stuff to get our agenda across. So you're definitely going to have to keep an eye on whether there are forces, and Islamist forces in particular in Egypt, who are going to try to link up with people either in the Sinai or in Gaza or anywhere and try and get their hands on the types of weapons that would allow them to perpetrate violence against the regime. At the same time, the Egyptian military has this well under control. I don't think they're going to let it get to that point. I mean, they're basically doing what they're doing in the Sinai to make sure that those weapons flows don't happen.
You know, Egypt's economy was very, very dependent upon, I mean, one piece of it was dependent upon tourism. And it seemed like tourism has almost completely gone away from Egypt. I know a couple of people who've gone over there, but that there's been a lot of warnings, especially for Americans, to stay away from Egypt and to be very, very careful in that environment. The economic situation has a number of people unemployed. It definitely has had a major impact on the society. I mean, how is Egypt trying to turn that around in terms of getting the economy back some traction?
So I think that for the Egyptian government right now, and for the military in particular, this is sort of a secondary issue. They're really trying to get hold of political stability right now. There's been a lot of talk about the interim government sort of being a technocratic government. I don't really see that. I don't see them making sort of any structural economic reforms that would actually sort of target some of their real issues. What I see there is they're going to depend on foreign aid from countries like Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Kuwait. These are all countries that after Morsi was removed, they were happy to see Morsi removed because they don't like the Muslim Brotherhood and don't want to see Brotherhood-affiliated forces rise in their own countries. But so the foreign aid from countries like this are at least going to get Egypt through this sort of interim stage until they can get their own government in place. And then once that government comes into place, then maybe they can start addressing some of these structural issues. But as you said, Egypt's economy, I mean, it's a mess. And I mean, tourism is just one small part of it. I mean, if you just take a step back from Egypt and think for a second, it looks like a very big country on the map. But the amount of land that people actually live on in Israel, it's actually much smaller. So it's actually 99% of the population in Egypt lives on the banks of the Nile River in a land area that is about the size of the state of Maryland. And if you just want to compare, there are about 5 to 6 million people living in the state of Maryland. There are 85 million people living in Egypt.
Wow.
This is a country that doesn't have enough resources to grow its own food. It's a net importer of petroleum products and hasn't been able to really supply its own energy needs and stuff like this. So there are a lot of, and besides all that, because it's a dictatorship and because the military is in power there, part of the social contract between rulers and people is the system of subsidies that make things like bread and fuel cheaper. And these are things that take up a huge chunk of Egypt's budget and mean that Egypt is sort of constantly running a deficit and not able to produce enough cash. So these are huge structural problems that whatever government comes into Egypt is going to have a lot more strength and a lot more authority than this interim government or anything that's come before it in order to tackle.
We've got a few more minutes. And in that dynamic, I want to look at with President Obama and looking at America, what are the implications of this and why are we so concerned? I mean, a lot of people will ask, well, why are we so concerned about Egypt? Why are we still so concerned about the Middle East? Why do we always have to have our hands in the pot over there? You know, as we kind of close out this segment, why is that the case?
Yeah, so there are two real reasons that The U.S. in particular, and I think most of the international community, sort of focuses on Egypt. The first one is the Suez Canal. A significant percentage of global trade passes through the canal. I think it's approximately 8%, and I believe 4.5% of global oil trade passes through the canal. So this is a major, major trade center and also a potential choke point if something should go wrong. That said, I don't think we need to worry much about the Suez Canal. That's basically a military zone, and the military has shown that it's not going to sort of let that be in jeopardy. But that's one thing. You have to keep an eye on the Suez. The second thing is that the United States has relied on Egypt basically since 1979 as one of its key allies in the region. 1979 was when the peace treaty was signed between Israel and Egypt, basically ending hostilities between those two countries. And sort of all the geopolitical realities in the region since then have revolved around this idea that Egypt has an interest and has a cooperation both with Israel and with the United States and isn't going to embark on sort of any sort of violence and military campaigns from that point of view. The U.S., and Obama has said this, and Clinton has said this, and Kerry has said this, the U.S. has really tried to turn its attention away from the Middle East. It wants to focus in particular more on the Asia-Pacific region. It wants to focus on China. It wants to make sure that China can't simply dominate the South China Sea. It wants to improve its ties with countries like Myanmar. And for the United States to do that, to make that pivot successful and to do it in a way that it can really trust that it can do that, it needs allies in places like the Middle East to hold things up. And what's really relevant about Egypt being in this level of political instability is that the U.S. is losing its allies in the region that can sort of help solidify and control that area. I mean, what's really happened since 2011 is you've seen basically a breakdown in the regional power sources in the region. For a while, Iran was ascendant, but because of what's been going on in Syria and because their link with Hezbollah has been broken because of that civil war in Syria, they're sort of hurting right now. Turkey and Qatar, part of the sort of Muslim Brotherhood, moderate Islamist forces trying to marshal their influence in the region. They were one of the bigger supporters of Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood coming to power in Egypt. But now Morsi's out, and now they're sort of teetering on the edge, and they're sort of trying to figure out what's going on. And then you've got the Gulf countries like Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, United Arab Emirates, who are also trying to assert their own interests. So it's difficult for the United States because it wants to turn away. It sees other priorities that it wants to take care of. But at the same time, you're sort of seeing a fracturing of all the old pillars of power and influence that it relied on to control the Middle East. So it's going to be difficult for the United States to sort of keep an eye on that and trust their allies in the region with all the different instability that's going on.
Going to be some interesting times ahead, Jacob. We're going to definitely want to talk to you again at some point to kind of keep abreast on what's going on in the Middle East. This could be definitely a longer discussion. I wish we had time for more, but thank you for providing some insight today on Fed Access.
Thanks so much.
When we come back, we're going to have Fred Burton. He's the vice president for intelligence at Fed, not at Fed Access, but at Stratfor. He's the vice president for intelligence at Stratfor. He's going to be talking about Mexico and what's going on down there on with our border country. There's a number of different issues that we need to be concerned about, whether it be drugs or people crossing the border. So we're going to get some updates about what's happening in Mexico. We're talking to Jacob Shapiro. He's a Middle East analyst at Stratfor. You can find him at stratfor.com. They're a geopolitical intelligence organization focusing on a number of different issues. Got some interesting stuff on their website. Please take a look at it. We'll be right back after this break on Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we've been having an interesting discussion about international issues on Fed Access today. We've been talking about the Middle East, and we've been talking about Egypt and what's happening in that country. And we've been talking about the Middle East as it relates to the implications to what's going on in the United States and why do we still need to stay abreast of the Middle East and what's going over there. But there's another critical issue that we really need to pay attention to, and we've been monitoring this on Fed Access for quite some time. But Mexico, our border country, the drug cartels and the drug war over there has not gone away. If anything, it's gotten even more rampant, and there have been more deaths and more violence in that country. And we need to kind of keep on monitoring that situation and trying to figure out what the solutions are. So we have Fred Burton. He's a vice president of intelligence for Stratfor. And again, you can find him at stratfor.com. They're a geopolitical intelligence organization that monitors all these international issues and provides forecasts and analysis and everything else. But Fred has been monitoring and keeping abreast on Mexico. He used to work at State Department, used to be the deputy director of counterterrorism there. He's got a number of years of expertise in these issues. Fred, welcome back to Fed Access.
Thank you for having me, Derek.
Hey, talk to us. Give us an update about what's going on in Mexico right now, Fred. I mean, right, the border country. You guys are right down there in Texas, so you hear about it almost before we get it up here in D.C. But what's happening?
Well, it is something that we're very laser focused on, just due to the proximity of not only our operations, but just the huge multinational corporation and just general intelligence interest of what's taking place in Mexico. This week, we've seen a significant event take place with the capture of Miguel Trevino. He's known as Z40 of the Zeta organization. He was picked up in Nuevo Laredo, which is the sister city to Laredo, which is right on our border, in possession of $2 million in cash, lots of weapons, and his accountant was with him, and just one security officer, which is kind of unique for an individual of that stature inside of Mexico. Usually they have huge entourages. It shows the pressure that's being placed upon these groups and how they've adapted in trying to keep a lower profile. But Z40's capture is certainly going to shake up the narcotics space as it pertains to the very lucrative Border Plaza, which is the international gateway where the bulk of the drugs that flow into the United States come straight through this corridor. And of course, this is a corridor that was controlled and is still controlled by the Zeta organization. So what we're watching is who's going to step up to the plate to take over. We've seen some speculation that his brother might be the person. He goes by the radio call sign of Z42. So this is really a very significant shift in counter-narcotics activity, and it's certainly a win for the new Mexican administration to be able to capture this man and to take him alive.
Hmm. Do you think that this is now a new concerted effort by this administration, the new administration in Mexico now, to kind of say, you know, because a lot of administrations have always boasted we're going to take on the cartels and everything else. Is there something that they're doing different for them to get this kind of capture? I mean, they're using, you know, better intelligence, or are they, you know, kind of changing the tide in some of these areas? Is there something happening?
I think the biggest pat on the back probably has to go to the U.S. government. I think the fruits of our labor are finally starting to pay off. It's been a long, slow drag to get Mexican law enforcement and the federal police and their intelligence service up the snuff, so to speak. But I think as you look at our anti-terrorism assistance programs, our training, for example, the Black Hawk helicopter used to capture this ruthless cartel boss was provided to the Mexican government by the U.S. government. So I think what you're seeing, Derek, is like in so many of these countries that we've helped over time, most notably like Colombia, when you start looking at the war on drugs, we're starting to see it pay off. And I think the Mexicans are doing a pretty good job now of capturing senior leaders. They're putting a lot of pressure on the drug cartels. And we have seen a reduction of violence across the country. Having said that, though, the troubling aspect is we really haven't seen reductions in cartel drug flows, meaning, yes, we have decreased the body count per se if you look across the country, so you don't have the horrific firefights taking place in certain areas, but it really hasn't put an impact on the scope of drugs that are flowing north, as well as just the sheer volume of stolen cars and stolen weapons that are moving south.
You know, with this, in terms of and with this capture and with this new kind of concerted effort, and now maybe American and Mexican officials kind of working together, It still seems that the traffic of drugs is moving into America quite swiftly. I guess the demand is still there from our side, and I guess that's part of the problem is that the demand is still there from us. So therefore, they're still trying to feed that beast.
Without a doubt. And this is one of the issues that why it's important for all of us in this country to understand. If you look at the horrendous homicide rates in cities like Chicago or even inside of D.C., and you think in concept of how many of these homicides are drug-fueled, drug-backed, or drug-related, this is why this is an issue that really is important to all of us. And, the ramifications not only to law enforcement and prosecutors, but just society at large, is one that, as a nation, we really have never gotten a handle on. And it's just not a law enforcement problem. We can't arrest ourselves out of this issue.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back after this break. We're listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we've been talking about international issues today. We've been talking about the Middle East. And also, we're talking about Mexico. Things that are going on in both countries have very, very strong implications to what goes on in America, whether it be our allies over the Middle East and situations that happening with Egypt, or whether it be situations that's going on in Mexico and our border countries with the drug cartels, with organized crime and everything else. But they all have an impact on us. And so we need to know what's going on. We're talking to Fred Burton. He's the Vice President of Intelligence at Stratfor. You can find him at Stratfor.com. They're a geopolitical intelligence organization focusing on providing forecasts and analysis on a number of these Middle Eastern issues, on a number of issues all over the world, a number of issues that's going on in Mexico and everywhere else. They're a good site to take a look at to keep abreast of what's happening. Fred, we were talking about Mexico, and we were talking about, you know, the drug cartels. We were talking about this capture of a major leader. We're talking about the demand in America for the drugs and the demand over there for the weapons. You know, with that, there's also the situation where there's been some concerns about whether it be kidnapping. You know, there's a Marine and his family that seem to be missing. There seems to be this either kidnapping or a rising death count in that country. Is it something? Is that still a no-go zone for Americans in terms of going over to visit? Is it a place that Americans can now go? Are there certain areas that are good, certain areas that are bad? I mean, what's the status there?
Well, you raise a very good question, and it's one of the questions we get here pretty much every day at Stratfor, with not only businesses but missionary groups or tourists that are trying to make a decision as to where they can go. You can go to Mexico, but you have to be very careful about where you're traveling and how you're traveling. For the most part, as long as you stay in some of the resort areas and stay on the actual resort properties, you're going to be okay. What we've seen over time and still see is a lot of people get themselves in trouble by going off the grid a bit, going out, having a little bit too much to drink, relying on local transportation or attempting to buy drugs or whatever, and they get themselves in bad situations. We have a tremendous number of missing Americans in Mexico that are unaccounted for. Unlike some of the hostage takings we see around the globe, there really isn't a long-term care and feeding by the Mexican cartels when they do capture someone. So when someone goes missing in Mexico, it's usually a very bad situation. And for the most part, we've seen a lot of folks go missing that are out either engaged in the narcotics business or out attempting to purchase drugs, or they place themselves in very bad situations based on poor choices. So it's important, if you are planning to go, to stay abreast of the government websites, like the State Department's website. They've done a very good job and have recently updated their Mexico analysis on their website at www.state.gov, and you'll see that they very boldly list no-go areas inside of Mexico. And I know that it is an issue in very specific places that you're wanting to visit. So I would encourage you to take advantage of all that kind of public available information and just make sure that you use your head when you go down there.
You know, in terms of, you know, when we're hearing about these kidnappings or we're hearing about certain people going missing, it's not necessarily for a ransom situation. I mean, a lot of times, you know, or is it? Or is it for ransom? Or a lot of times these people are just walking into situations and honestly are getting killed. I mean, is it both or what is it?
We're seeing a tremendous combination of all of the above, like you mentioned. One of the more interesting dynamics, which is very unique to the Texas-Mexico border, is there's a tremendous amount of crime against the illegal alien population on the Texas side of the border. For example, there are a lot of cross-border kidnappings, contrary to what DHS and other others would want you to believe. There is a fair amount that takes place. Unfortunately, there's a lot of intelligence gaps on that, but if you talk to the border sheriffs, they will tell you that a lot of this occurs. And there's certain areas on the border that the border sheriffs don't even patrol because of the violence and the danger. And nor does the border patrol, to be blunt. And so,
and Fred, let me interject real quick. Is this the case because this is illegals and so this is not reported? I mean, because they're not American citizens, so to say. I mean, is this almost almost an underground enterprise where there's these kidnappings and because, you know, they're deemed as illegal aliens, no one ever even tracks this stuff?
You're absolutely correct. A lot of these persons at times are innocent victims. A fair number are engaged in the drug trade to begin with. We see a lot of home invasions on the border as a result of that, where you'll have suspected stash houses or people that are owed money or dope will be victimized. One of the more interesting things that has taken place here that I think it's important for your listeners to know is we had a very sophisticated hit on a lawyer in Southlake, Texas, which is a very high-end neighborhood near Dallas. And that is 400 miles from the border. And based on our analysis and research of what took place, you actually had a Mexican cartel hit team that came into the United States, found this individual, and killed him in a very Mexico-esque kind of hit. And again, this was 400 miles from the border. When you start researching these kinds of incidents, and There isn't any good cohesive databases because of all these different law enforcement agencies that have very disparate records, and sometimes you have a violent crime task force that's working one case, sometimes it's a joint terrorism task force.
And everybody's not sharing information either.
No, of course not. That's one of the things that still hasn't been fixed. So, and then you get into the national data collection points, and even under the Uniform Crime Reporting, the national crime statistics that go back to, I think it's 1927, kidnapping is not a UCR crime. So you don't really have good data points to even look at. But the hit in this very upscale, high-end neighborhood outside of Dallas has really sent shockwaves across the law enforcement community in Texas specifically because of not only the sophistication, but the number of people that were involved to get this done.
Was this because of was this lawyer involved in drug-related issue? I mean, was he involved in some kind of way, or was he defending somebody? Did anybody understand the nature of this?
It's our understanding that he was a Mexican lawyer that was representing some cartel officials. Now, whether or not this is some sort of vengeance or some sort of retribution is unclear. The FBI, DEA, and Homeland Security and the Texas Rangers are looking into it. But the one thing that is crystal clear is the team came into the United States from Mexico, carried out the hit, and left by the same day.
Wow. And, you know, that obviously has a lot of implications for a number of different reasons, not only because of a hit on American soil, but whether it be terrorism or anything else, that somebody could come through, you know, get that deep into America's soil, do this, and then go back and disappear into Mexico.
Without a doubt. You get back into the whole aspects of your homeland security perspective. How could this happen? How do these people go about doing this? How do they get into the country? How do they get the weapons? How do they go about departing that quickly? This isn't surprising for those of us who live and work and cover this issue in Texas. But if they can strike within 400 miles of the border, if you look at the geography of the United States, there's a lot of capabilities within 400 miles of the border
right.
that you could carry out very similar other attacks. The more important issue, Derek, or the more troubling issue from a takeaway is we really don't know how many others like that have occurred.
Right.
We only know about this one because it was in such a high-end upscale area. It would be like carrying out an attack in the high-end shopping area of Tyson's Corner.
Right, right. Exactly. You know, Fred, we only got a few seconds to talk, but I want to talk about, you know, people talk about technology, about drones, and we're starting to see a lot more drones, and people say the drones can do the border and everything else. I mean, is there a technology fix for maybe controlling the borders of keeping drones 24 hours? Will that help, or is that something, again, that we're really putting too much, you know, we think is going to be the magic bullet, but it's not?
Well, as it pertains to the border, due to the sheer size and the rural nature and the terrain, the drones do pay dividends because you're able to patrol areas that you can't or you don't have the resources to put into these places. So it helps you fill and plug some of those intelligence gaps. So as it pertains to the border, the drones are being effective, predominantly looking at high travel areas or areas where you have intelligence to indicate that you have a large human trafficking or a large drug trafficking operations underway.
Well, that is hopeful. That's some hopeful news, and maybe we can use more technology to maybe start controlling that border, because, I mean, of course, we cannot put enough people out there. We can't build a fence around that way, and I mean, hopefully we can do some things to maybe quell people sneaking over the border, like this assassination attempt and many other attempts to sneak either people over or sneak drugs over or whatever the case is. We're talking to Fred Burton, and he's giving us an insight on what's going on with Mexico. He's been breaking it down in terms of the cartels and in terms of any border issues. It's definitely something we need to keep abreast. Fred, we're going to have to check back with you in a couple months to kind of keep our eye on the track of Mexico. But we want to thank you for being on Fed Access.
My pleasure, and thank you for having me, Derek.